Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Brady McCartney, your host today. I'm joined by Chris Wells, editor of Environmental Justice in Postwar America and professor of environmental history in the Department of Environmental Studies at McAllister College. Chris Wells, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So to start off, could you just tell us a bit about yourself, your scholarly background, and how you became interested in environmental justice and editing a reader about environmental justice in the U.S. sort of post-World War II?
Absolutely. So the short version of an answer is it really became clear to me in the classroom that something like this would be useful. But the much longer answer has more to do with a slightly different version of the question, which is what's a white environmental studies professor doing writing a history of the environmental justice movement? And to get to the answer to that one, it takes a little bit longer. But I grew up in Atlanta, went through the public school system there. So the first school with a white majority student body that I attended was college. And all through high school, I kind of looked at people who identified as environmentalists and rolled my eyes a little bit and thought that they were trying to sort of be activists without engaging with race. And I had a little bit of disdain for that. Fast forward, when I decided that I wanted to go to graduate school in history, I didn't actually intend to be an environmental historian. That was a happy accident, I think, of wandering into Bill Cronin's graduate seminar on environmental history and sort of having one of those eye-opening, oh my goodness, I didn't realize you could do this sort of moments. And I sort of had this big conversion experience where I went all in on environmental history. And my first book, which came out of my dissertation, really didn't put race anywhere near the center of what I was doing. I was trying to answer a question about why Americans drive so much more than people do in other places, other countries. And was really trying to pick apart what I was defining as the car-dependent features of the American landscape and how and why those sort of took over development practices in the United States. And so race was relevant to that discussion, but was not a driver of you can't write about cars without running into these puns everywhere. So I apologize. Race was not a driver, although it was certainly quite relevant to car-dependent landscapes, and especially to white flight and suburbanization, those sorts of things. So when I got to my own college classroom and was teaching these questions or teaching the topics on my own, my students kept coming back to these larger questions of race, and I certainly encouraged them in that direction. But I didn't know as many answers as a new assistant professor. I felt like I needed to have answers, and my students were constantly pushing me outside of what I already knew. So I began to try to wrestle with what I felt like was the most important question, which was, why are environmentalists as a group so much whiter than the rest of the country? And as a historian, I started looking for primary sources. I started looking for answers in the ways that I've been trained to do. And I had no idea that I was working on a book. What I was really doing was collecting primary documents, both so that I could make sense of them, or the questions that I was asking, and so that I could share them, those documents, with my students so that they'd have a better idea of what was going on. And it really was framed in terms of the failures of environmentalism to be a more diverse movement and to ask a broader set of questions than it was specifically about the environmental justice movement. But eventually I realized that the documents I was collecting might be useful to other people. And with some outside encouragement, I eventually realized that I was working on a book. And so that's the longer answer to your question.
Oh, thank you. That background is really helpful. And I think brings your own experience, your own humanity into this conversation, which I think is always helpful, right? Because scholars tend to be attracted to issues that are connected in some way, even if it's not always clear at the beginning, to their own lived experience. And growing up in a place like Atlanta, which, you know, certainly in recent history has been a black mecca to think about race, especially when you're in the kind of public school environments you were in, I think is really helpful. So thank you for sharing that. So just to sort of define some important terms. So we're talking about environmental justice, but I think hand in hand, of course, is injustice. So sort of building off the last question, so what is your conception of environmental justice and environmental injustice? And then how do you think about these two terms in relation to something like environmental racism, which I think you have also highlighted in your last answer?
Yeah, great questions. So environmental justice as a term focuses attention on the movement by that same name. So I think one answer is that environmental justice is what activists say it is. And thinking about it in other terms like environmental injustice or environmental racism opens it up a little bit more conceptually and isn't necessarily tied to the political movement with that name. So that's one place that I go anyway as I sift through an answer to that question. So thinking about environmental justice, the sort of initial insight that really sparked a lot of activism came after the Warren County protests with the publication of Toxic Wastes and Race, publication by the United Church of Christ. And it really, for the first time, building on something that the General Accounting Office had done, really documented the ways that toxic waste sites in particular were disproportionately located in Black and Brown neighborhoods. And so the idea that you could statistically document the locations of obviously problematic things, toxic waste disposal sites, uncontrolled toxic waste. There's a whole set of categories, hazardous wastes. The idea that you could show that these things were systematically and disproportionately located in particular kinds of neighborhoods, so much so that the single best predictor of whether any individual would live in a place where they might be exposed to such things was race. This was a revelation. And that insight that burdens are not distributed equally across different geographies was sort of crucial for the early activism. But you'll notice I said that this report came out after the Warren County protests, and I feel like I should talk a little bit about those because they demonstrated that environmental justice is about much more than just unequal burdens. That, you know, those documentable patterns of disproportionate exposure for particular groups of people. So the quick version of the Warren County story is that there was a pair of guys who were in a business that had a lot of toxic stuff, in this case PCBs, and they didn't want to pay to get rid of it safely. So they decided to dump it. And they ended up rigging up a giant tank hidden by a box on the back of one of their trucks. And they literally ran a spigot from the tank to the side of the car, and they drove up and down the highways of rural North Carolina to get rid of these PCB-laced transformer liquid for electrical transformers. And it just created a huge, awful, toxic mess. And the state was on the hook for cleaning it up. And when they did, they had to, after they'd collected all of the material, they needed to put it somewhere. So the Warren County protests emerged because a very poor, heavily African-American county, Warren County, was chosen over its objections and without its knowledge initially as the site for a repository for all of this toxic waste, which had been gathered because of environmental legislation in order to protect people from it. But where they decided to put it and how they handled the process of creating a new repository for it, which turned out not to be safe and turned out to leak into the groundwater and create all sorts of problems, which the activists had predicted, it really highlighted a whole range of other issues that I think are core to environmental justice as well. So on top of the fact that those toxic waste repositories tend to be distributed in very particular ways and very particular types of communities more often than not are the hosts for them. It also raises a whole set of really profound questions about environmental decision-making processes. So it was an environmental cleanup that caused all of that toxic waste to be gathered up and dumped on a poor Black county in an unsafe way. And so questions about who comes up with decision-making processes, who controls them, who are the leaders, who sets the agenda is one whole set of questions. Then another set of questions is sort of who has access to the decision-making processes, what kind of participation is open and available for people. If folks actually wanted to say, hey, I think this is a bad idea, how is the system set up to accommodate those sorts of complaints and then to resolve them? Who gets to adjudicate them? And then there's a whole set of questions about whose knowledge, whose environmental knowledge gets privileged in those processes? Is it experts and government bureaucrats, or is it the people who actually live near a place or in a particular environment and who are being asked to carry the biggest burdens of some change? So all of those things, so from the unequal distribution of burdens to the very specific ways that environmental legislation can actually increase the burdens on particular groups of people, and the ways it controls access to decision making, I think is all a huge part of what environmental justice is. The third and sort of final piece of it is that environmental justice activists expanded, they insisted that the term environment needs to be bigger than early environmentalists often defined it. So there was a lot of pressure within the mainstream environmental movement to think of the environment primarily in terms of nature, and especially distant nature, untouched nature. And this was by no means the only way of thinking about the environment within mainstream environmentalism, but it was one that a lot of big organizations that had a lot of power and a lot of membership, think Sierra Club, tended to privilege. And so environmental justice activists really pushed for us to think about the environment as places where we live, where we work, and where we play. So that's a famous line from Dana Alston. And then people have amended where we learn and where we pray to that as well, to get at institutions like schools and churches. But sort of emphasizing that everyday environments, the places where people are also environmental and are proper focuses for environmental activism, was a major shift that environmental justice brought to those discussions.
Yeah, and I think that comes out in your essays in this book, but also in many of the sources you choose. One of my questions that I think you've nicely anticipated was basically you focus on humans. You focus a lot on human health and housing and their relationship perhaps to the natural world, but you're emphasizing like urban areas, right? Not necessarily wilderness in sort of a traditional sense, or as many you might think of, right? Your advisor, Bill Cronin, right? Like he, I think, helpfully wrote that essay, The Trouble with Wilderness, which I know has caused a lot of sort of pushback, but also I think importantly, right, he was talking about how the wilderness is in an urban environment, just like the urban environment is the natural world, even if it's not always thought of in that way. So you've nicely anticipated that question, so I won't belabor that point. But I think, you know, you bring up topics like blockbusting, for example, which I don't know if you want to describe that, but, you know, your emphasis on housing and redlining and sort of these policies that shaped neighborhoods so that the people who could live in certain environments were restricted. You know, you focus on racial covenants, and this is an environmental justice reader, so that makes perfect sense to me. But if someone were to, you know, come to this book and sort of place the emphasis on environmental, they might be surprised that you are really focused at different points, not throughout the book, but on environmental spaces that are often urban, or, you know, I guess it just, yeah.
Yeah. So the whole first part of the book, I think the title is The Nature of Segregation, but it follows that framework that Dana Alston provided. The environment is where we live, where we work, and where we play. And so it's a collection of documents on housing, on workplaces, and on recreational opportunities. And the focus is segregation. I mean, that's the word for what I'm talking about. And I guess there's an implicit argument. Readers don't really have clear arguments because the voices are speaking for themselves. But the framework for selection certainly was based on an important premise. And the premise is that when you are talking about disproportionately distributed environmental burdens, you're basically saying some places have burdens and others don't. And so to have environmental justice problems where people of color, where BIPOC individuals are disproportionately exposed to environmental burdens, it means that you actually, that my premise is that segregation, which gathers BIPOC people into particular places, is a precondition for environmental injustice. Because it also happens to be those places where BIPOC people have been confined is the wrong word. In certain historical contexts, confined is the right word. Have been pushed, have been constrained, have been guided by big institutions and laws and practices, right? The forces that create segregation are also the same forces that put environmental burdens in the places where they have put those BIPOC people. So segregation turns out to be really important for understanding environmental injustice, at least for the way I understand it. And so the first part of the reader really does lay out some of the legal and institutional and social practices that created and enforced segregation with an eye on how that connects to environmental injustice. So that was a very deliberate choice on my part that reflects one of the ways I think about what environmental justice is, how it functions spatially. Segregation is just a really big and important piece of that to my mind.
Absolutely. And I think there's sort of a natural counterpoint in the reader where you talk about solidarity movements and you include sources where, you know, your speakers, your writers are referring to sort of interracial, multi-ethnic movements and how to build sort of common cause, which I think is helpful in how do you address segregation, right? It requires a lot of people who are involved, if not everybody who is involved sort of in that dynamic, right? You can't just have sort of the people who are being segregated apart from sort of the institutions that are trying to segregate these other communities away from them, right? I think they go sort of hand in hand if you're going to address these issues.
That's right. And to sort of go back to the questions that I was running into in the classroom, which are really about the failures of environmentalists in the 70s, 80s, and 90s to identify these problems as problems and to allow those obviously discriminatory systems to continue to operate, and then to pretend that the environmental results weren't being systematically produced, right? That was the big issue, I think, that drew me into all of this. And I guess the flip side of that is today, if you like me are occupy an incredibly privileged position. I live in a neighborhood in St. Paul that's right by the college where I teach that is disproportionately white and disproportionately wealthy compared to medians in either of those categories. It has a lot of environmental amenities. It does not have a lot of environmental burdens. So if I were only to pay attention to my immediate environmental experiences as a resident of the city, I wouldn't think that there are many environmental problems that I needed to pay attention to. And so that what you're calling collaboration, if you don't see it in your immediate everyday life, because you live inside of a system that distributes these things in radically unequal ways, whether you're talking about money or environmental amenities, or lack of money and environmental disamenities, if you're not aware of that, then finding common cause and understanding the systems that exist that cause those unequal distributions, then it's going to be really hard to do anything.
Indeed. So you're sort of getting at some of the issues in this next question, and you have throughout many of your answers, but how does the environmental justice movement sort of overlap or differ from the civil rights movement and the environmental movement, right? Because I believe in your opening essay, or maybe it's Paul Sutter's essay, right? There's this discussion that the environmental justice movement is sort of, I guess maybe it's the Washington Post quotation, where the civil rights movement and the environmental movement sort of got married and the environmental justice movement was born, right? So I don't know that that's the best metaphor, but we can discuss.
I'm not sure it's a metaphor that works very well at all. But I do think it's one that people are drawn to and like to believe is how we ought to describe it. Going back to the original question, I think that the environmental movement was much bigger than any one thing. And there's been a lot of great historical scholarship showing that environmentalism wasn't just the sort of big membership-driven organizations that are pretty well known. That in fact it was a much more wide-ranging movement with lots more interests and concerns than the sort of conservation-directed version of things that we often think of. So just to give you an example, there's a part of the reader that focuses on the period right around the first Earth Day, April 22nd, 1970, and which was a moment when the environmental movement sort of burst out of some of the previous constraints that had kept it in check and really became nationally prominent in a way that set it up for a whole series of significant victories across the 1970s. And if you go back to that movement and look even just at what people were saying at that original Earth Day, it's a much more diverse set of issues that people are interested in than we often associate with mainstream environmentalism. So even that distinction I said earlier about the conception of the environment as being a place that is mostly distant and mostly about untouched nature, you go back and you look at what people were saying at that first Earth Day, they're saying much more than that. And they're embracing a definition of the environment that is as wide-ranging as the one that environmental justice insisted on.
Yeah, I was struck by, I think it's the Ed Muskie speech, the senator from Maine, I believe.
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, that speech articulated a very inclusive idea of the environmental movement that has just not matched my sort of experience, but very much matches sort of the environmental justice movement in a really helpful way.
Yeah. And so there's that Ed Muskie speech. There's a task force report from the EPA published in 1971. It's called Our Urban Environment and Our Most Endangered People. And they actually, it was written by a couple of interns, according to the front matter. And the sorts of issues that they take up and call to attention and sort of say, hey, this is what the EPA needs to be thinking about when it comes to urban environments, sound a lot like what a decade later was being described as environmental justice. So before there was a movement, there were environmentalists who were talking about these things. And then there's another section in that precedes that one, which is people who were self-identified as civil rights movement people who were talking in really sophisticated ways about environmental problems. So the amount of overlap between what civil rights people around 1970 were saying about environmental issues and what self-identified environmentalists were saying about civil rights issues had a lot of overlap. I mean, they were basically on the same page or on a very similar page, might be a better way to say it. But one of the unfortunate realities is that overlap didn't mean that the civil rights movement and the environmental movement got married, to use the term from the Washington Post article. That's not what happened. And so the sort of social justice approach that had been important early on in the early 70s started to get pared back and to be refocused on other things. And the interest among civil rights leaders in what we might think of as environmental problems began to get pared back. And so those movements never quite came together in the way that, by going back and looking what people were doing and what they were saying, it appears they could have. They just didn't. And so that's one of the big missed opportunities, I think, for the mainstream environmental side, is that people were raising these issues, they were discussing them in pretty sophisticated ways. They had ready allies among civil rights leaders, and those coalitions and common interests just never gelled. And in fact, a lot of the big victories that happened during the 1970s, especially with the toxics movement, which were designed to do things like clean up all those PCBs that got sprayed onto the roadside in a fly-by-night dumping operation in North Carolina, right? Those environmental laws actually set up some of the problems that sparked the people of color-led environmental justice movement in the 1980s. So it was that the decade of the 70s had its chance, and it was very much part of the discussion. But instead of going in the direction that we think of as the EJ direction, they turned toward a more expert-driven, top-down version of environmental governance that increased burdens on BIPOC people rather than tackling them head-on.
Right, and I'm tempted to say it's the law of unintended consequences, I think I've been on this earth long enough to know that maybe some of the consequences were in fact intended.
You asked about environmental racism earlier, and I think that's a term that captures maybe the intentional versus unintentional dimensions. That there are clearly places where big corporations intentionally targeted places where they that were dominated by BIPOC individuals because they saw them as economically disempowered and politically toothless. So they were specifically targeting those places because they thought they'd run into fewer obstacles. I think we can call that racism, environmental racism. And then the other side of that is sort of the unequal enforcement of laws. So if you've got a system that's designed, say, to clean up roadside waste, you would hope that whatever technical safety parameters you set up to define a safe dumping space would actually be adhered to. And part of the issue at Warren County was that they were issuing waivers to their own technical criteria about what was safe for a disposal facility. But you can also see this in things like Superfund, right? The EPA has pretty consistently been, and there are documented studies showing this, has pretty consistently been faster to clean up things that are in whiter and wealthier areas than in places that are poorer and darker. It has also issued heavier fines for polluters in the former rather than the latter. And so that question of unequal enforcement, the law can look like it is going to be applied the same to everybody, but if the enforcement is unequal, then and is unequal in ways that reflect clear patterns, I think you can ascribe some intentionality to that.
Yeah. Again, indeed. So you handpick sources from a variety of archives and eras for the reader. Podcasting is an audio medium. So would you mind describing a favorite source or two? Since our listeners are, at least at this point, are not yet readers of this wonderful reader?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Edmund Muskie's speech on Earth Day 1970. That's one that I still like to go back and look at because it highlights the missed opportunities, I think. In pretty powerful ways. These are things that people knew about, were talking about, were being urged to take seriously. And that was the path not taken. I think there are a lot of sources that stand out. I don't know. I think about the National Parks sign pointing to the area that it had formerly designated as a Negro area in Shenandoah National Park. So just to see the open segregation being practiced in the national park system, I think is pretty powerful. There's a 1972 survey that the Sierra Club conducted of its membership. It had 140,000 members or so in 1972. And one of the questions that it asked was whether the club should concern itself with the conservation problems of such special groups as the urban poor and ethnic minorities. And it reported that 58% of those polled opposed the club going in that direction. Although it did note that a majority of members who were 35 or younger supported going in that direction. It was only 54%, so not a resounding majority, but a clear majority. And even just thinking about how they worded that question, it's so problematic. But it really highlights the ways that these were questions that people were talking about. Is this something we should do? I mean, they actually polled their members to see. And we can see that the overwhelming answer was no, we shouldn't. Shortly, or right after reporting on the demographics of the club, which are whiter and wealthier than average in the United States. So I think that there are various sources like that that are sort of powerful in the ways they encapsulate various issues that thread through the reader.
Yeah, I think I've already sort of shown my cards, but the block busting section where you have this, is it appropriate to call him a realtor? I'm not sure exactly what his title is, but where he's describing basically what I guess selling a home in a white neighborhood to, I think, a family of color or, a black family, and basically him outlining the process of sort of, I guess, changing a neighborhood is maybe the most diplomatic way.
So cynical.
So cynical. And yet I can also, like, that guy totally exists, right? He exists today, no doubt. As somebody who grew up in Washington, D.C., like, I definitely encountered that guy growing up as I saw D.C. transformed, in the late 90s to its current state, where it was a majority black city. And now it's, I believe, officially, black folks are not a majority in the city. And that was 20 years. And block busting felt, whatever term we'd call now, gentrification might be a useful, maybe not exactly the same, but certainly a related term. I would also point out that you reminded me of Van Jones before sort of his CNN days.
The Green for All
speech. Yeah, at Power Shift 2009, I think it was.
Yeah, the keynote from Power Shift. That was a really powerful speech. You can find it on YouTube. So anyone who's listening to this and doesn't have access to the reader, go look up that speech and watch it on YouTube.
Yeah, you can see why the Obama administration wanted him to be the Green Jobs Czar. I forget the date on the speech, but that he may have been serving in that role or about to transition. Of course, before he was, involved in sort of made up political scandal, as far as I'm concerned, and then lost the job and is now, sort of the CNN talking head that still is incredibly eloquent and I think is a great messenger for all of his causes. But at that time, he felt like he was talking in a way that I think could have led to the more inclusive sort of environmental justice movement. I think, Ed Muskie and others were sort of articulating in 1970.
So. Yeah. Yeah. There's one other, I realize this is one that I have on the door to my office. So it seems worth calling attention to. So it's called From One Earth Day to the Next. And it's an image of two different people at a podium. And so in the left panel, there's a sign behind a guy at the podium that says EPA, and the speech bubble is, you have to be patient. These things take time. There's a bunch of angry people out in the crowd holding signs that say clean air now, stop the dump, green earth. And it's labeled environmentalists across the bottom. And then in the right panel, it's the same lectern, but the EPA has been replaced with a sign that says green earth. And instead of EPA, it says environmentalist. And the speech bubble says, you have to be patient. These things take time. And in the audience, we have a bunch of people labeled minorities, and their signs say environmental justice, minorities dying from toxic wastes. That juxtaposition and talking about who has power and who doesn't and when and the sorts of things that they're trying to get powerful people to pay attention to is one that immediately jumped out at me when I saw it.
Yeah, I think the larger point is listeners really need to track this reader down because there are so many visuals, right? There's a lot of text, but there are visuals like the Shenandoah sign that you just sort of have to see to believe. And, you know, while some of this stuff is certainly in archives and you can track it down, I think this reader does a nice job of sort of making connections and sort of making not so obvious connections as well. Well, I have some process questions, but I do want to sort of stay on content for at least one more question. So you end the reader with excerpts from an interview with Tom Goldtooth of the Indigenous Environmental Network. He mentions the relationship between the environmental justice and climate justice movements. And I'm just wondering how you think sort of the environmental justice movement has evolved in this post-war period, and like how you view the environmental justice and climate justice movements in relation to each other.
It's a great question, and I'm not sure that there is any one correct answer. I think there are lots of relationships. So I can sort of tease out a couple of them just to gesture at what those might look like. So one is to say that what we might think of as classic environmental justice work, which is fighting toxics and sort of the ways that they are aggressively located in places where BIPOC people live and work and play, continues to be a huge and vibrant part of what environmental justice activists do. But I think you can also see that the term justice has been embraced by a whole host of other activist movements, food justice, climate justice, just to name a couple, that are essentially taking the insights and the orientation of environmental justice and moving beyond the particular environmental issues that sort of animated the movement early on and are bringing new sorts of more focused issues into that justice framework. So climate justice is doing that, right? It's sort of starting with one of the big observations that EJ activists had, which is that the environmental burdens are not equally distributed. Certain people will have to carry them in ways that others won't, and they will be much heavier. They'll have a much bigger impact. They'll be much more destructive and disruptive for some people than for others. And the people who will carry the biggest burdens are almost overwhelmingly the more marginalized people in society. And that you can see that between global North and global South, many of the worst climate change impacts will be suffered by people in the global South. And you can see it within individual countries as in the United States. I think that observation is one that's transferable, and climate change is a big enough issue, a big enough set of interconnected environmental changes that also happens to share the power dynamics. Historically, the nations who are most responsible for causing these problems are the ones who've grown wealthy off of burning fossil fuels to build big robust economies that generate a whole lot of money and resources. And so the people who've done the most to cause the problems are the ones who have the most resources to adapt. The ones who have done the least to cause it are the ones who will suffer the biggest burdens. So there's an obvious parallel there, even though the issues are quite different from say, hey, you're locating a toxic waste disposal facility that's going to leak PCBs into the groundwater near my house is different from the sorts of issues connected to climate change. And yet they're also entirely of a piece. It's also true that many environmental justice activists have become climate justice movement leaders. And so there's a direct connection between the two in that sense. It's a lot of the same people and doing the same work just in new venues. So those are some of the ways that I think they overlap and differ. But I think there are others. There are others too. So those are more suggestive than conclusive.
Absolutely. I realize the climate justice movement is, especially for a historian, a very new movement. And it's hard to make any sort of declarations. It's probably hard enough to say anything declarative about the environmental justice movement if you date it back to, 1980, right? So, So a more process-oriented question. The book was published in 2018. Your most recent sources are, date back to 2017. So I guess sort of a three-pronged question, and we are running out of time soon, but I want to make sure this question is asked. So is there a source that you didn't include at the time that you might now that, because its importance is maybe, a more obvious or just something you weren't aware of? And then sort of the flip side of that, is there a source you would add? Based on the last 5 years, obviously we've continuing to go through the COVID-19 pandemic. So there's a lot of environmental justice connections. So sort of a source that existed at publication, that you might consider now, and then sort of in the last 5 years, is there anything you would clearly want to add to this?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are both great questions. I think on the, I'd have loved to do it and wish I could have list. That list is way longer than we have time to go through. and so partly the answer is about having to whittle things down to meet a certain kind of end product. But copyright is such a huge issue for a project like this. And I wish I were exaggerating. I spent almost as much time working out all of the copyrights to be able to publish this as I did making decisions about what to include or not. It was just an enormously time-consuming and difficult process. And there's just a huge long list of things that I couldn't include because of copyrights. So I think those would actually be at the top of my list. If you could go back and include anything, what would you do? It would be things off of that list rather than something more recent. I do think though that from the last 5 years, the COVID-19 pandemic has brutally highlighted the inequities in American society that are sort of at the heart of the reader. And I think there are definitely sources on that topic that I would want to include if I were doing it today. But rather than tell you what I would pick, this is actually, I think, my favorite assignment for the book, is to say, well, if you could add a section, what would you focus on? What sources would you use? Where would you look? What would you want to highlight? Because those are really the questions that matter. And I'm one guy. I'm a white guy. I'm an environmentalist wrestling with a very particular question about the failures of this political movement that I support to do things that I really wish that it had done, and to figure out how to do those things now in the present, right? So that's the frame that I bring to this. But I think that anyone coming to a collection like this ought to pay attention to their own questions. And so I'd turn it back on the reader and say, what would you add? What should be in here that's not? Where would you find it? I think those are all important questions.
Fair enough. As you were giving that response, I started sort of toggling through, you know, a variety of sources. And I should probably hold off and not say anything, but I'm tempted to say, we were chatting about the difference in budget for a podcast like the New Books Network versus, say, the Daily, the New York Times Daily. And there was an amazing interview with one of the gentlemen who led the union organizing efforts in one of the New York City facilities for Amazon. Just thinking about sort of quote unquote essential workers and how they had a fundamentally different experience of the pandemic, you know, exposing their health, their bodies, their families in a way that a lot of people didn't have to, because they could work at home or they could, you know, just place the order online and then just wait for, you know, the thing to show up at their front door or whatever. I'm tempted to go in that direction just because I think it brings together a lot of the threads of this reader, but I will hold off and really think about that. But I do encourage you to do an update or a second volume, because I think this is such a rich source, and hopefully some of the items you wanted will eventually be in public domain, because it's a shame that that would be sort of something that keeps significant historical sources out of a book. With this value to its reader. So, last question. If listeners are interested in learning more about environmental justice, are there specific scholars or books you recommend? You obviously reviewed a tremendous number of sources, thinkers, scholars. Anybody or anything that comes to mind?
Yes, in fact. So one of the kind of painful things, actually, of doing a book like this is that it's entirely based on primary documents. So it is not a deep engagement with the scholarship on the topic, at least not in a way that you can see in the reader itself. So I think anyone who's interested in reading more, there are a couple of people who've been hugely prolific in their scholarship on environmental justice. So Robert Bullard is one of those people who has been at this from the very beginning, and has published a lot of stuff that's his own voice, but he's also been remarkable in bringing together lots of different people in edited collections. So you can pick up almost anything that he's done and get a sense of things. David Pellow is another person who's more recent, but who has done a lot of the same things that Bullard did. In terms of sort of recent books that I've found really provocative and wonderful, there's a new book called Waste, or a newish book called Waste, by Catherine Flowers, who's spent a big chunk of her career focused on human waste and septic systems in rural areas, trying to deal with the public health and justice issues wrapped up in that. Fascinating book. As Long as Grass Grows by Dina, gosh, I realize I've never tried to say the name out loud. Gilio Whitaker. I wish I knew the answer. But that's a wonderful book. Looking at environmental justice in indigenous communities, providing a big history there. A couple of more focused volumes, Elizabeth Hoover, The Rivers in Us, looks at fighting toxics in a Mohawk community. And Tracy Brin Voyle's Wastelanding on uranium mining in Navajo country. Just wonderful, wonderful, wide-ranging books that I'd recommend heartily to anyone.
Absolutely. And just a plug for New Books Network, Dina Helio-Whitaker was interviewed previously by one of my colleagues, I think late in 2021. So you can look that interview up.
I will go find it. And thank you for telling me how to pronounce the name.
Yeah, no worries. I've been at a conference with her. So, you know, she helped me. She clarified the pronunciation, which is always helpful.
Right. Well, if she hears this, my sincere apologies. Yes. And you wrote a wonderful book. So
absolutely,
thank you.
Absolutely. I would also plug Ellen Spears, who blurbed your reader.
Absolutely. And absolutely.
I'll be interviewing her this summer. So she will be in the New Books Network Environmental Studies feed in a few weeks. So
another fantastic book that really looks at the environmental movement side of things. And the point that I was making about environmentalism being much more than the big green membership organizations, I was thinking of her when I said that. So another fantastic book.
I had that feeling, but I didn't want to call her out. But this is a great time to do it. So, all right.
Absolutely.
Well, Chris Wells, thank you so much for joining me. And that ends another episode of the New Books Network. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was my guest, Chris Wells, editor of Environmental Justice in Postwar America, published by the University of Washington Press. The book is now available online and in bookstores across the country. This concludes another episode of the New Books Network. Until next time.